In terms of down moments, we've definitely come flirted a few times with running out of runway, especially in the early MVP days. Those are really not fun moments. You have to get really creative, and those are really when you have some of the most exciting times in a startup. And I think our best moment was probably either our acceptance into UC Berkeley Skydeck, which is one of the best accelerators in the world, or our partnership with the British Columbia Hospice and Palliative Care Association, which is one of the largest hospice and palliative care associations in the world. And we essentially provide our services to hospices and palliative care centers, as well as children's hospitals in the entire province of British Columbia, which is something we're very proud of.
Welcome, Alex. Welcome to YFML.com, the podcast, a place for young entrepreneurs. Get inspired by people like you who don't just talk about the dreams and aspirations, but actually do and take action. So today we have Alexander Jivov. He is joining us from Toronto, Canada, and he started Hopeful. He'll explain later what it is, but he's helping nonprofits monetize their socials, right? So yeah, why don't you go ahead and explain us a bit what you've done so far and yeah, a bit about your background.
Absolutely. And thanks for having me, Roger. I'm really excited to be on today. So Hopeful is the first social fun tech fundraising technology platform that specifically allows charities and nonprofits to get active on all major social media channels, even if they have lack the capacity to have been doing it previously. Let them see what's working and what's not working. And then through a proprietary storytelling AI dashboard, actually letting them see why is it people are donating and not just hitting the like button and making that a repeatable and scalable process. So essentially letting them see, is it text commonalities, image commonalities, video, what is it that's specifically leading people to these kinds of donations, and then letting them actually make that a repeatable process and then fundraise directly on all major social media platforms. We launched in August of last year. We work with about 200 organizations in Canada, in the UK, in the US. And then we've been around for about 2 years. First year was pretty much operating in stealth. And a little bit about myself. My resume is a little bit of a weird one. I originally started in journalism as a reporter for the National Post, the largest newspaper in Canada back in the day. Journalism started shifting much more towards a different kind of journalism that I was comfortable with as of my time there was coming to the end. And then I made my transition into sales. First, having worked at Politico, which is one of the largest congressional legal intelligence journals in the world based in Washington, D.C., where I went to school. And then working with a variety of B2B SaaS companies in Canada, such as Touch Bistro. I joined there at employee about 85, left at about employee 450. And then in the meantime, I've worked in nonprofits my entire life as a sales consultant, marketing consultant, web developer, and as a board member of two nonprofits currently. And that's what led me to Hopeful. So I've done a little bit of everything, primarily focused on sales, but always been interested in the digital part of sales, digital marketing, storytelling, and everything around that.
Wow. Okay. That's pretty cool. And can you tell us a bit about the story, how Hopeful started and why? Yeah.
Well, Hopeful started really as an idea as I was doing, it was right after I graduated from the University of Toronto for my computer science and development degree. And this was just about 3 years ago now. And essentially what we quickly noticed was that there was a huge amount of gaps in terms of how data was being used in the nonprofit space. And there was a recognition that they really needed to digitize. And this was before COVID happened. Worldwide, only about 5% of nonprofits use their data to make decisions, which is a very low number in comparison to the for-profit world. So we really spent our first year and a half, as I mentioned, getting to the bottom of that and doing research. So we essentially were interviewed 150 nonprofits. We started the ideas kind of being a CRM or a data management pipeline. Mm-hmm. But over time, it became apparent that the thing that was really missing in the space was something to handle social media, but handle it in the specifically nonprofit and impact way. So there is no one that does what we do in the nonprofit and impact space. And that's, we basically reverse engineered Hopeful from product market fit interviews into what it is today.
Oh, wow. And do you think that there's room for in the future to expand to for-profit organizations, or you're going to stay in the nonprofit field?
Well, we've already expanded into the higher education space. We definitely think that there's a lot of opportunity to be going into new verticals, but this is something that we really wanted to start an impact business first and foremost, do some good in, for the world, but in a not traditional impact startup way, because by working with nonprofits, we have a little bit of an impact in many, many different causes rather than focusing on one specifically. So we definitely have a lot of vision for what Hopeful can grow into, but right now we're really focusing on helping the sector that needs us the most, which is the nonprofit space.
Okay. And do you think that, so you mentioned you are on the board of two nonprofits, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that came before or after, like, before or after?
It came as a mix. So I might keep up my nonprofit work on the side. So one of those came into existence after Hopeful, and one of those was before Hopeful.
So, yeah. So talking about the one that came before, did that influence you to get into, like, you know, like, did you get the idea while being there and said, hey, like, they're lacking this, or they're not doing this correctly, I should do something to help them?
Absolutely. It was more, I really noticed it when I was doing kind of my own professional work. I was using my newfound web development and coding skills to really help nonprofits in and around Toronto. That's where I noticed it. I obviously did notice it as well with the, not with the organizations I work most directly with, but I didn't realize it was a holistic problem that could really be solved by a startup until I really expanded my view.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And, you know, in this podcast, we talk about how, you know, you meet your co-founders. You told me off record, you met your co-founder in India. How was that? Like, you were on vacation and you just met him and decided to start it? Or?
Yeah. Basically that. I was on vacation in Northern India. I used to be a chef back in the day as well. So I was doing some research on a cookbook I was writing several years ago. And then my co-founder and I saw and crossed paths while we were in India. And then we've been working remotely together ever since. He's been in the process of coming over to Canada for a while, but obviously as a result of the pandemic, it's been a tough go. But me and him get along great. And that's a very remote-based co-foundership.
Oh, wow. That's actually pretty cool. And you're going to have physical offices, right? Just remote?
Yeah. We've been fully remote this entire time. So we're a team of about 10 people spread between the US, Canada, and India, and Pakistan as well.
How's that? Do you think it works well? Or?
Yeah, well, it's definitely, definitely is unique, especially those specific time zones. There's a 10 and a half hour, 11 hour difference. So we definitely had to get used to it, but we've gotten used to it and it works for us now, especially on the tech team, which is the most split between Toronto and India and Pakistan. That was an interesting go. For myself, our sales and marketing team is all in the US and Canada. So I had an easier bit of a day-to-day than my co-founder did, but it works well for us now.
Cool. And so you mentioned you transitioned. So you started your career in sales, right? And then you transitioned to journalism, but you also had technical background. So how was the transition?
So as a quick correction, so I started in journalism.
Okay.
Journalism in a lot of ways is its own kind of sales, I like to think about it, because it's all about storytelling, right? Everything, I've always been very adamant about other interviews I've given as well, is that it all comes down to storytelling and the kind of stories you give. It all comes down to sales. Sales is all you telling a story with a specific objective. Journalism is telling a story for the objective to inform. That's what a lot of human society comes down to, is how effectively you can tell your story. So it wasn't too big of a transition in terms of a career, as a transition in terms of how I thought about the stories that I told. And if you're thinking about your career and your life in the lens of storytelling, it actually makes things much clearer, because you always have that central anchor to be thinking about how you're actually conducting yourself and for what objective you're conducting yourself for.
So you think entrepreneurs should, like, or aspiring entrepreneurs should start in sales, because that will help them, sell their product or idea?
Well, I would never make that blanket assumption, but I definitely have seen that having a sales background and being able to talk is tremendously helpful, especially if you are going after a venture-backed business. But as always, if you have your own skill set and your own talent, focus on your skill set and your talent. That's what finding a co-founder is for, right? Yeah. That's what finding your team is for, is to fill those gaps in. That is always very helpful, but it's also equally as helpful to be able to code. So if you are missing a skill, don't try to force yourself to learn a skill that you're not going to be, you're going to be inherently weaker at. I would definitely find a co-founder you work well with who can fill that skill for you.
Cool. And so your co-founder, what brings to the business that you don't then?
Well, he's our chief technology officer.
Okay. So
the man's a wizard when it comes to everything tech. He's done a lot of amazing work, not only building out the original vision we had for our product, but beyond that. So that's, we're basically a yin and yang situation here, where we fell two halves of the hole.
Cool. And so you started Hopeful under 30, right?
Yes, I did. So I'm not even 30 now. I'm 27 okay. Now. I started when I was 23, 24. So it's been a very fast couple of years, but now reflecting on it, it's been like a decent part of my 20s.
Yeah. And so, you know, I hear and, you know, have experienced as well that starting something at a young age might come with, kind of, I don't know how to put it, but rejection from your family or your friends or society as a whole. Because, if you're in your 20s, you're still considered very young. And so did you get any of these reactions, or have you ever not been taken seriously because of your age, anything like that?
Well, specifically for us, my family came from a venture background. So the pushback I got was actually like the pushback you would get from a venture firm. Mm-hmm. So as a result of that, I had a very different experience. I didn't get rejection because entrepreneurship was appreciated, but I got pushback in the actual inner workings of a business in terms of how you would get a pitch. And that was really helpful for me to grow and to learn. So I was really lucky about that. Of course, I had already made a good amount of money in my early 20s from my sales career. But still then, there was always the open question of like, well, what are you going to do? How do you pay yourself effectively? And that's something that you just have to have a plan going in with for that to make sense.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And so now that you just mentioned your family come from the VCs and stuff. So how, and I read you raised $400,000 Canadian dollars. Mm-hmm. I guess that was easier coming from your family, you know, being in that space or not. Like, how was the process to raise that amount?
Well, the process of raising the money is definitely an interesting one, especially if you're not in a hot space. Did it make the initial startup easier because you learned how venture capital funds think? Yes, but that journey is unique for every organization. Like if we were, say, like a blockchain company, well, not so much considering how crypto is doing right now, but if we were a blockchain company or an agri company or something working on EV technology, so electric vehicle technology, we'd probably have an easier go of it. We had a bit of an uphill battle because the moment you hear a nonprofit as a VC, that's an entire other conversation to have. But it was really helpful to kind of work around that initial barrier because then we got some really good investors right off the bat and also helped us get into some excellent accelerators right off the bat, like our work with Ryerson DMZ and our work with UC Berkeley, which has been a wonderful partner to us for a long time now. So that was, we had a bit of a unique go that way.
And so what, I mean, you'll tell me if you used any, but any sales skills you use to raise funding?
Well, of course, you have to know how to pitch. You know how to handle objections. You have to know how to sell your company. It's all sales. Venture funding is sales. It's just a bigger dollar, not a bigger deal. It's like enterprise sales. It's like what I usually equate it to.
And anything you did that cost you a no, like what? What would you recommend young entrepreneurs who are trying to raise capital to do, right? Like go after like someone, like ask them five times and no accept rejection, keep trying, or just on the fifth time just
what we always learned is venture is a numbers game. You're gonna get many no's no matter what kind of a business you're in. So you just have to be comfortable with failure. Don't keep going back to the same well. There's so many venture capital funds, angel funds. There's so many different sources of funding. You just have to keep going after all of it and see what ends up being a good fit. That's all it is. It's really just creating that pipeline and making that effort. And it's as simple as that. If I had any kind of like pearls of wisdom, I would give it, but it's just that basic. Is go after it, go have as many conversations as you have, and it'll work out.
Cool. And so I think you kind of answered this question, but why nonprofits? So you said, you know, you've wanted to get into the nonprofit space since forever, right? But what's the main difference, you think, between nonprofits and for profits, like startups?
So in terms of the difference between for profits and nonprofits, nonprofits, there's a lot of differences. I don't even think we have the time to get into all of them, but you also have to realize that nonprofits are organizations that are really constantly in a state of their fighting for their own survival. And as a result of that, there's a recognition of they have to advance to be like the for-profit world. But because of the competitive nature and the size of the nonprofit space, there's often a lot of inertia because people come, go, often don't treat it as their first career. So as a result of that, it's always an uphill battle. Once you can have a champion within an organization one day and then not have it the next because of just natural turnover. And that happens much more often in the nonprofit world than the for-profit world. That being said, the conversations and the impact that you see in the nonprofit world are awesome. Like, we get to work with some truly unique and amazing people. We learn a lot every single day. So the learnings and the impact you have are felt much more significantly working with just nonprofits because you get to see directly what you're doing for people around the world.
Yeah, you can see the good impact, right? Mm-hmm. And so do you think that having nonprofits as customers will give you a longer, so you'll have them longer than if they were for profit, like the turnover is less. Like, I don't know if you.
Yeah, you, I don't know how. I don't know if I can like answer that question. It's still
okay.
Sales. It's dependent on organizations, but we have about 98% retention with our customers now, and we love our customers and they love us. But that's not really specific to the space, right? It's dependent on a lot of different factors.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Like in general, what would you say is the best thing that Hopeful has taught you, and maybe you'll apply to any possible future venture you do?
Hopeful really taught me how to be light on my feet, being able to pivot and create new strategies rapidly and really not get too ingrained into how specifically I was actually doing all of my selling and creating strategies with our team, and also how to obviously run a company remotely, which is seems like that's going to be very important forever. But being able to really, once you see a plan's not working, being able to drop it and move on to the next one. I was used to be a person for a long time who'd really zero in on plans and carry them through no matter what. Now I'm much more flexible in terms of the things I think about and the way that if I see something that's working early on, I'm going to drop it and I'm going to try something new and really experiment much more. That's also key for startup founders in general, is experimentation.
Take more risks. And have you pivoted or... Oh, you told me, right? It used to be a CRM kind of platform, right?
Well, that wasn't a pivot. That was more general product market fit. We've pivoted in terms of how we've accepted revenue, expanding from a SaaS startup to doing payment processing and now looking at consultancy. So we've definitely done quite a few jumps. We haven't done any kind of hard pivots, but that's because we spent the first year and a half just figuring out what our fit was. And if we hadn't done that first year and a half, there would have been a lot more hard pivoting involved.
And that year and a half, that was the MVP, I guess. You were
exactly. That was our MVP.
Cool. And you know, taking into account startups, you know, to find an exit, I mean, or at least to go public, it takes them 10 years. So imagine 10 years from now, you want to start something else, right? You want to get into a new venture. What would that venture be like? In what space or what kind of thing you like?
So I thought about this, and I know we've discussed it in the past. I honestly don't know. I very much so focus on the ventures I'm focusing on now. There's a lot of very exciting technologies that are going to be coming online, especially in the quantum realm, and quantum computing and quantum AI. That's something I'm looking at, of course, with blockchain and cryptocurrencies here to stay. But in terms of specifics, I don't know. I'm very much so focused on what Hopeful does and the impact Hopeful can have. And that's something I'm really excited for the future.
So let me change the question then. How, like, where do you think Hopeful will be in 10 years? I mean, I know it's a long time, 10 years, but let's say 5 years.
Well, my issue with that question is that startups, it's impossible to tell, right? Yeah. Startups is one of the craziest rides you'll ever have as a career. So it's the same as, like, if you get a question, where do you see yourself 5 years from now? We never thought we'd see a pandemic come from nowhere, right? So I can't give an answer to that question, because if I knew that answer, then my job wouldn't be as exciting as it is. It's you got to be able to lean back and just really control what you can control for, and then just kind of let the journey go by. So I have no idea. I have really no idea, and I'm just excited to see how it plays out.
Exactly. That's also the fun part of it. Yeah. And so if you had to start Hopeful again, what would you do different? What would you do different?
I would definitely have done more studying in terms of pricing and how one actually monetizes effectively right out of the gate. We did a lot of work on what was the product need, but not the actual distribution strategy. We ended up building a great go-to-market, but the monetization on that go-to-market was something we quickly had to do a lot of work on. So I would have done a lot of that and really expanded the way I did my product market fit questions, and really made sure that everything foundationally in terms of, like, your HR, your accounting, all those kinds of things, we really flew by the seat of our pants on that for a long time. And that caused a lot of annoying evenings and a lot of hiccups. That's something that getting those foundational things done, even with, like, cheap and easy technology right out of the gate, saves you so much time as a startup founder. And it's always important to focus on that. So yeah, foundational elements, and make sure you got your pricing right before you launch.
Before you launch, because, so did you change it after you launched then? Like,
we've changed it 3 or 4 times after we've launched as well, so we've expanded.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the normal thing to do, even though maybe it's not the right thing to do, but yeah, you experiment.
It's something that we did. It's usually when people change their prices, it's like expanding or changing suites. For us, we basically realized we were leaving, there was money being left on the table, and we weren't charging effectively for what we were providing and the value we were providing. So it's a difference there.
Okay, cool. Did your customers tell you, oh, maybe you should lower the price, or it was you that?
No, it wasn't anything. Our customers, with nonprofits especially, it's something that was tricky to work with in terms of pricing, because it is a space that does like things to be free. So something we had to really analyze deeply internally and make those decisions on our own, and again, run experiments with. So on the flip side, we didn't have the luxury of the for-profit space where you can kind of test your pricing with your customers as much and get good results. But I still wish we had kind of done more internal studies of it up front, because that was a fun challenge to work through, and I learned a lot from that. But at the time, it was there was a lot going on there.
Cool. And, you know, moving away from a bit from Hopeful now, and thinking of your career as a whole, right? What's the biggest down moment, but in a way, and what's the best one?
Well, again, super tough questions. In terms of down moments, we've definitely flirted a few times with running out of runway, especially in the early MVP days. Those are really not fun moments. You have to get really creative, and those are really when you have some of the most exciting times in a startup. And I think our best moment was probably either our acceptance into UC Berkeley Skydeck, which is one of the best accelerators in the world, or our partnership with the British Columbia Hospice and Palliative Care Association, which is one of the largest hospice and palliative care associations in the world. And we essentially provide our services to hospices and palliative care centers, as well as children's hospitals in the entire province of British Columbia, which is something we're very proud of.
Cool. And so you mentioned Berkeley's Skydeck Accelerator, but also Ryerson's DMC, it's called?
Yes, it is.
So how did you get accepted into them? And was it your plan to get into accelerators at the beginning, or it just happened to
Well, the Ryerson DMC is kind of our local town accelerator incubator, and it's one of the best incubators in the world for very early stage companies. I personally got, our plan was to think about accelerators, but we got really lucky because I knew a lot of the founders who were in the DMZ. It got recommended to be highly when we were in the very early days. And the sign of a good incubator is if you make those connections before you go in and they help you on your early stage. And that's really what they did. And then with Skydeck, that was already when we were farther along. We had revenue in place. So that was more of a traditional interview process, tightening up the pitch, and then really making sure that we could, again, sell ourselves as to why we should belong. And then we are one of 14 companies, I believe, chosen out of several thousand applicants. So that was something that was a big high moment, as I mentioned as well. But again, it comes down to selling. You need to sell the vision of where things are going. And that's more than VCs, I would say, and other funding sources for accelerators, because they help you all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so would you recommend young entrepreneurs to target accelerators, like to try to get into an accelerator?
I would definitely say an incubator is awesome if you have one available. And that's what I'm talking about, like your very, very early stages when you need the most guidance, especially if it's your first time. That helped me a lot. This is my first company that I founded. On the accelerator side, that depends. If you're growing like a rocket ship already, maybe you don't necessarily need it. But if you're going out to like the West Coast and you're going to the Valley, those are some of the best way to build connections that you wouldn't be able to get easily on your own. So that one's a judgment call, but I always can recommend an incubator. Personally, with Skydeck, absolutely love them. Absolutely love the DMZ team. We're still in touch with both teams regularly. So it's a special place in my heart, but incubators for sure. If it's your first time, accelerators, depends.
Okay, cool. Makes sense. And yeah, one of the last questions here. So how do you leverage your connection? So, you know, I know there's people that have problems with this, but at what point do you become spam to other people? Like how often you need to reach out to them? And yeah, I mean, I know like you're used to being sales, so you must know like at what point you should stop, right?
How often? Yeah. Well, generally, again, depends. Broad question. If it's like, generally the cadence is once you reach out the first time, you have the first call, you follow up 2 days, 5 days, a week, and then make a judgment call from there. But we always make sure to have our weekly newsletter. We have events regularly once a month. It's if you start feeling like you're spam, you're probably spam. That's the rule.
Yeah. Cool. All right. And, you know, the last question, I ask this to every single guest that comes to the podcast. And so, you know, some hate it, some love it. What's the plan to conquer the world? And in your case, maybe it's to have a good impact in you know, every part of the world.
Well, we're not conquering the world. We're making the world a better place, right? Okay. So our plan right now is to really make sure we can get all the nonprofits in the US and Canada successfully being raising money on social media, making sure they can get millennials, Gen X, Gen Z donors in front of them, getting them donating actively, because making sure the youngest generation is donating is one of the most important things and one of our mission statements at Hopeful. Once we have that underway, we think we're going to have a great, very easy time expanding into Europe and beyond. But really just focusing on having as good of an impact as we can, making sure we have events that are also providing charitable giving so we can give back to our local community beyond. And that's it. We're just trying to do as much good as we can, where good pays, good things pay good, essentially.
Cool. Well, so thanks, Alex. Thanks for coming to the podcast. Actually, you're the first business that works with nonprofits that comes to here. So that was great having you here. And thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me, Roger. Really appreciate it. It was a great chat.
Yeah. All right. Bye-bye.